Good evening, Little Masters, and welcome to episode 203 of the Prancing Pony Podcast, where Parma and Tuluva, the book, shall come again. But not today.
No, not today. And if you're not sure why Alan made that reference of all references, you must have missed last week's Tolkien Reading Day episode on Hope and Courage.
That's right.
So, go fix that.
Fix it later, though. We want you to listen to this one first, because you're in for a lot more hope and courage from us tonight.
Yeah, you could say that. There's going to be a lot of courage to do what we're about to do once again, and hope that it'll be entertaining and not too hard.
And that it won't crash on us.
Exactly. So, folks, go ahead and pull up a bench in the common room. I'm Sean Marchese, the real-life Lord of the Mark, and I'm here with the Men of the West, who has the face of one that goes seeking embarrassment, having no hope, Alan Sisto.
Thank you. Thank you? That's really the wrong phrase. That's close. It's half right.
You know, I compared you to Dernhelm. That's not such a bad thing.
No, that's true. That's true. Folks, of course, my co-host's words can only mean one thing. Today, we are going to be welcoming a few of our patrons to join us for our, hard to believe, 14th quarterly Questions After Nightfall.
Indeed. Now, for those of you joining us for the first time, welcome. Here at the Prancing Pony Podcast, we're working our way through J.R.R. Tolkien's Legendarium, a few pages at a time.
We study the details, we make connections to other writings, talk about our favorite themes.
And we have a lot of fun along the way. So we're glad you've joined us.
And we hope you'll be glad you joined as well. But once a quarter, we take a break from our read-through and welcome a few of our supporters to join us here in the common room and bring along some of their very best questions.
Why do I feel a little bit like Bertnoth right now? Maybe because, as always, we have no idea what we're about to be asked. So Alan and I are going to be answering their questions as best we can with the resources that are available to us here in our recording nooks.
And preferably between our ears.
That too.
As with previous Questions After Nightfall episodes, aside from any possible edits for, you know, nervous coughs and time spent flipping through pages while we look for an answer, we will be presenting this as it was recorded live. Everything you hear in the show will have been recorded during this session.
And if you'd like to get in on the next one, go check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/prancingponypod. We'll continue recording these Questions After Nightfall episodes every quarter, and we're going to be inviting patrons at the Elrond's Honorarium tier and higher to join us.
It's just one of the many ways we're saying thank you to our patrons, giving them the opportunity to get to know us a little better, make us laugh, stump us, and occasionally embarrass us in the best possible way.
We do love being embarrassed.
Speak for yourself, Sean. All right. Are we ready to go ahead and open this up to our listeners tonight?
I think we are.
I think so, too.
Why don't we go ahead and call on our first guest tonight? And that is going to be Jim.
Jim.
Well, hello. How are you doing?
We're doing well, sir. Welcome back.
Doing fantastic. How are you?
Doing very well. I'm afraid I don't have a Tolkien pun for you this time. I'm in enough legal trouble as it is.
More than just legal trouble, sir.
Well, I mean, you try to do your civic duty, so I came up with a way to store electricity using only crackers. Then you get arrested for assaulting battery.
Oh my gosh.
But before I get to my question, I did want to ask you whether you've had a chance to look at the latest Amon Hen, number 287, that just
I have.
Came out. Oh, yeah.
I have not looked at it yet.
Yeah, interesting new articles in there. There's a new author who contributed an article that might be of interest to you. And I understand he's available for interviews.
Is it you, Jim?
Yeah, it is me.
Awesome. I can't wait to see that. I will go and take a look at that as soon as we're done recording here tonight.
Okay. The theory proposed is a little controversial, so brace yourself.
I think you emailed us about this one, didn't you?
I think you did.
But anyway, I was wondering if just, you know, we're a couple weeks behind in the podcast because this is taped a couple weeks afterwards. So I'm just finishing up the chapters on Ents. And I was wondering when the Ents came marching two by two, hurrah.
Right.
Hurrah, the Ents. I was wondering, do you think there's likely that Leaflock and Skinbark might have awakened from their slumber to come down and join the march, given that the entire forest seemed to be bracing itself based on the Ent boot? And I was also wondering, Skinbark's people were having a lot of trouble previously with the orcs felling trees. Now, I've chopped down a tree with an axe once. That was enough because it takes a lot of work to chop down a tree with an axe. So for the orcs to spend that much time out there just chopping down trees for mischief, much less feeding the fires, they must have run into some of Skinbark's people. They must have realized there were these demons of the wood out there and that they were big and scary and kind of strong. So I'm wondering if the attack on Isengard was quite as big a surprise as they might have thought, or if the orcs had an idea, or maybe they just, they knew about Ents, but they didn't know quite what they were capable of. Maybe the Ents were reluctant to show their full strength or too sleepy to do so.
That's fair. I mean, I don't even think that the Ents were aware of their own capabilities for the longest time.
Yeah.
But you're thinking, Jim, maybe some of the orcs might have been picked off while they were chopping down trees in the forest, and so they had some stories.
I was just wondering, that were they quite as sudden a surprise as seemed to fall on Isengard, or were they? Was there some familiarity, you think, among the orcs, and they were just disregarding the threat? You know, the Saruman spied out their ways some time ago.
Huh. Well, I think it's pretty clear that Saruman certainly discounted the Ents and their willingness to become involved. It could be that he was convinced that no matter what he did, the Ents would remain above the fray and neutral and not get involved.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that he assumed that they couldn't do anything significant. That seems a little foolish, but Saruman's a Maia, so he would have known, or could have at least known, about what the Ents did in stopping the dwarves that had ransacked Menegroth and then got taken out by Baron and a bunch of trees in the First Age. So my hunch is he was counting on their neutrality, counting on them simply being passive and not being involved. I mean, you know, these guys are standing around griping about the Ent wives, and they're not really out going and doing anything about it. They have in the past, but they're not active, right? They're very tree-ish. They're very, you know, lying low, letting things happen around them. I think that's what he's counting on.
I think the reaction that we see when the Ents storm Isengard, I think that tells us exactly what Saruman thought. He thought they were not going to get involved. He was completely taken by surprise.
Hmm.
Maybe that argument sounds circular, but I think that that is proof enough that Saruman really did not expect them to do anything. And I think that that implies that they probably had not been doing any kind of retaliating for the destruction that the orcs had been perpetrating on the forest up to that point. I mean, maybe, you know, since as Jim says, it does take a while to chop down a tree with an axe, and maybe a couple of orcs had been picked off here and there. I wouldn't be surprised if maybe some Ents were, you know, stealthily killing a few orcs.
But who amongst the orcs would care about that, right?
Well, that's just it. And I can't imagine that there would have been enough of that going on for the stories to have come back to Saruman.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, at what level does it rise to information that gets to the top of the chain of command?
Right.
These are just orcs. They're
fodder.
Yeah. Some of them disappear. So what?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And maybe the orcs had some stories that they shared about, you know, the scary forest and, Snaga disappeared last week in the forest while he was cutting down
trees. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Right, right.
But does that rise to Saruman's attention? Probably not.
No.
I don't think he's really that concerned about his orcs.
Rumors, that sort of thing. It's overconfidence on Saruman's part and a lack of good battlefield intel.
Well, yeah. And actually, as we're talking here, I see that Katie has just popped up in the chat. It's kind of like how Sauron never imagined hobbits sneaking the ring in, right? I think underestimating your enemies is a sign of the bad guys in these stories. They're always underestimating the good guys. And so I think that Saruman underestimated the ability of the Ents to strike back, or the willingness of the Ents to strike back to his own destruction, just as Sauron underestimated that anybody could have done, you know, what they did with the ring.
Yeah, I think so. I want to go back now, though, to Skinbark and Leaflock, the first part of the question, the idea that, you know, well, would they have been involved in some way?
I've been thinking about that for a couple of minutes now, too.
Yeah, me too. I kind of want to say almost certainly not, would be my initial thought.
I would be willing to put money on the fact that Skinbark probably did not.
Yeah.
We know that Skinbark suffered some trauma.
Yep,
and he's, you know, he's gone into hiding up in the high places, and he will not come down, Treebeard says.
He will not come down.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I think we're talking about Ents who have lost a lot of their Entishness in many ways.
Yeah.
You know, as Treebeard says, of us three, and he's talking about himself, Leaflock and Skinbark are not much use for this business. And this was just the business of talking about this stuff. I mean,
true.
At this point, you know, Treebeard had already cooled himself down. Oh, I'm going to go get that Saruman guy. Oh, wait, you know, I better not. I better think twice now. He says, Leaflock has grown sleepy, almost tree-ish. He stands by himself. He used to rouse up in winter, but now he doesn't even walk then.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Skinbark, like you said, was just deeply traumatized. I don't think he's involved at all. He will not come down, like he says.
I completely agree. I would say that Leaflock, I think, probably cannot. He's just grown too treeish.
Yeah, he's incapable of it, while Skinbark is...
Skinbark might be capable, but he's not going to. Yeah, I tend to think that they both are not going to come be a part of this.
Yeah.
And I think that's why Treebeard says that. I think he knows them well.
Then he goes on to say, look, it doesn't matter. We don't need them. If I can get some of the younger Ents involved, we're going to be just fine.
Yep.
He immediately just chalks it up to they're not going to be there. So
right.
That was a good question, Jim.
Very good question, Jim. Thank you very much.
I like that.
Not as good as the answers.
well, thank you.
That was very kind. All right. Who do we have next up, Sean?
All right. Next up, we have DeMay.
DeMay, welcome back. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure.
Welcome back, DeMay.
Okay. I was thinking actually about Patti Smith, who had a song about horses coming in like waves, which led to this great big domino effect about white horses. And this is speculation. I don't know that there's any place that Tolkien himself or Christopher said why he talked about white horses so much. But just off of the top of my head, on the back of an envelope, I came up with a dozen distinct references dealing with white horses. All the way back to Nahar, he was white with golden hooves.
True.
And then there was Ecthelion shows up to greet Tuor in Gondolin on a white horse.
Mm-hmm.
And then in The Hobbit, Gandalf's got a white horse, unnamed.
Right.
And then the riddle, the white teeth on the Red Hill.
30 white horses on a Red Hill. Yeah,
yeah, right. So we got white horses there. Of course, the pony, it's a white horse on the sign. And it just, like I said, it just domino. Asphaloth. Glorfindel also had a white horse when he took on the Witch King and said, you won't die by the hand of man. And so on and so forth. So why so many white horses?
That is an interesting question to me. Sean, I don't know that I have an answer, at least off the top of my head. What sort of reason would he have? Is it, again, some of that visualization? Just like we have a lot of black enemies, the orcs are often...
I think that's exactly it. I don't know that I have a better answer for it than just a white horse is a great symbol for the good guys.
Purity and all that. Yeah,
yeah, the purity and the telegraphing the goodness of the people who have white horses, whether it's Gandalf and the Hobbit, potentially Gandalf and Lord of the Rings, depending on whether you think Shadowfax is gray or white.
Yeah, we'll get to that, actually. We're coming up real soon. Yeah.
But I know a lot of people see Shadowfax as white, and I think it certainly works for Gandalf's purity.
Right.
You've got Asphaloth. You've got Nahar, as DeMay said. Yeah, I mean, I think it works. I think it serves well to telegraph the purity of the riders and the goodness of the riders in much the same way that Éomer tells the three hunters that Sauron keeps stealing the black horses.
That's true. So Marilyn mentioned something that actually was on my mind because I was researching it for one of our upcoming episodes on the King of the Golden Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with the White Horse of Uffington, right? The that ancient carving.
That's right. Yeah.
That's only a handful of miles away from where Tolkien lived and worked.
I seem to remember Tom Shippey talking about that.
And Shippey does talk about that. So we're going to get into that. I don't want to go too far into that, but he talks about that in comparing Anglo-Saxons to the Rohirrim.
Mm-hmm.
In The Road to Middle-earth. And it's a really great comparison. I'm looking forward to getting into that. I was literally outlining that discussion just today. So
that's awesome. Yeah.
Marilyn got to it right before I did. And that may be something.
I was thinking of the flag of Rohan, you know, with a white horse on a green background.
And that's exactly the point that Shippey makes, is that white horse is just down the road.
Right.
You know, carved into the ground.
Yeah.
So that very well may be one of the inspirations for why so many of the horses were white.
Yeah, but I just think it's a symbol of good.
I think so.
I think if I were writing a fantasy story and I wanted to show how good the good guys were, I mean, you know, white horses are a way to do that. I mean, you see that in Westerns. Tolkien was inspired by Westerns, too. You know, the bandits always have black horses and the good guys usually have white horses. We know
that's
Tolkien
true.
Was inspired by Westerns as well.
Yeah.
So it could have been a little bit of that, too.
That's true. James Fenimore Cooper and a number of others. Yeah.
Yeah, and like the old cowboy stories and things like that. He was really interested in those. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I think it could just be that. I just think it makes for good symbolism. I bet there's probably some Anglo-Saxon symbolism there too, maybe in literature that I just don't know about. Maybe not Anglo-Saxon, but probably some medieval symbolism.
Well, I was going to say Anglo-Saxons notoriously weren't big on the whole horses into battle thing.
Not in battle, but they rode them, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, they rode them. They just didn't ride them into battle. That was the whole thing.
Right.
That's partly some of the things I'm digging into for our upcoming episode on the King of the Golden Hall.
I don't want to spoil any of that stuff. But, but yeah, I mean, still, there might be some medieval referent that he's thinking of there where, you know, the good guys have white horses and the bad guys have black horses. It wouldn't surprise me if you see something like that in the Song of Roland or something.
That's true. There's also just the visual pop. You know, you want to make something distinctive, right? You want to give your main characters something that enables them to stand out a little bit.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
A hat tip to Jim on that, actually. I mentioned it, but then I just saw that he said the same thing. Might also be because a white horse stands out and is very memorable. No doubt about it. You know, that's the thing. You want to give these key characters in key moments a real strong visual for the reader to imagine. And, you know, a dull gray as opposed to the shiny gray of Shadowfax. But, you know, just a brown horse is just a horse. But, oh, make it a white steed and you've got a whole different thing.
Are you with me on the Shadowfax's gray thing now?
That's I am.
Okay.
Yeah. I am. There's just too much in the text that makes it clear. He was like a gray shadow before them. I think that line alone was the convincing thing for me.
Well, I'm spoiling a future episode again, but
that's okay. Go ahead. I think everybody knows where you're going.
Well, just
with
the fact that his name is Shadowfax to me tells me that he's a gray horse.
But yeah, I was going to say the word nerdery that you're going to pull out on that, I'm sure is going to be very helpful as well.
But so we'll be revisiting that very soon.
That we will. Well, that was a great question, DeMay. Thank you for letting us speculate on that. Sean, who do we have up next?
All right. Well, next up, we've got Joe.
Joe, welcome back, sir. How are you tonight?
Doing all right. How are you guys?
Doing great. Thank you.
We're doing okay.
So I had a question about several fires that are mentioned. And so there's two references in the Aina Lindale, and then there's one pretty significant one in book two of The Lord of the Rings. The first reference in the Aina Lindale says, Iluvatar shall give to their thoughts, the secret fire being well pleased.
Mm-hmm.
And then farther along, it says that Melkor had gone often alone into the void places, seeking the imperishable flame.
Yeah.
Yet he found not the fire, for it is with Iluvatar. And then, of course, Gandalf famously says when he is facing off with the Balrog, I am the servant of the secret fire, wielder of the flame of Anor. The dark fire will not avail you, Flame of Udun.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, what is the difference between all of these different flames and fires and secrets and imperishables and all of these different things? I'm wondering if you could shed light on that.
I think we could. We spent a lot of time ourselves figuring that out. And I think we started off kind of on the wrong foot back in early season one. I tried to differentiate between the secret fire and the flame imperishable.
I remember that. Yeah, I think we thought at first that maybe the flame imperishable was like sort of the source, like the master flame, right? And the secret fire was sort of an instance of that, or?
That's kind of how I initially pictured it, was the imperishable flame being that thing that is within Iluvatar that he can then bestow upon things that make them, you know, living or real, and that would be the secret fire. But then there's a line in Valaquenta that really does make it seem like the two are the same. If you look in Valaquenta, I'm going to find the line itself. Iluvatar gave to their vision being and set it amid the void, and the secret fire was sent to burn at the heart of the world, and it was called Ea. Well, earlier when they talk about that, he says almost the exact same language, but he uses the flame imperishable. So really, the two are synonymous. So the secret fire and the flame imperishable are things that belong to Iluvatar and that only Iluvatar can bestow, but that then once a thing has that, it has independence of its own. It has existence of its own. I would almost say life of its own, but it seems to go to inanimate objects too, right? Like the earth.
Well, I think that in most cases, it functions like a kind of sentience, right? It is what bestows sentience upon living things.
Right.
But you're right. He does say that he set it to burn at the heart of the world, implying that either the earth has a kind of sentience or maybe it's just that's where it is and that's where he draws upon it to give sentience to,
that could be,
to beings. I don't know.
That could be, because it does seem as a general rule to be that thing that gives independent existence. And there's another time where it's not mentioned explicitly, but it's certainly strongly implied. And it has to do in chapter 2 of the Quintus Silmarillion when Iluvatar gives independent life to the dwarves, right? Before that moment, the dwarves don't even shirk from the hammer. They are automatons. They are like, you know, fancy toys that Aule can, you know, they're posable figures hey, look, I got a new, got a new pop mini.
They live only by his being, right? They move when he thinks to move them.
And when he's thinking someplace else, they don't move.
Right.
They don't have any will of their own. But then Iluvatar gives them, it doesn't say gives them the secret fire or gives them the flame imperishable, but he's now given them their own life. These things have now a life of their own and speak with their own voices. And that's evidence of the flame imperishable, evidence of the secret fire.
Right. I want to go back to something we were talking about a moment ago about the secret fire burning at the heart of Arda.
Yes.
Because I see Joe pop this into the text, and I think we talked about this when we talked about Tom Bombadil, the idea that Tom Bombadil, if he is some sort of a self-sparked spirit of the earth, he could be sort of a side effect of the flame imperishable being within Arda.
Right.
And he could have just been this being that sprang into existence out of that. Of course, we don't know that for sure, but that's one possible interpretation.
That's true. And I wanted to go ahead and come back to one line that I mentioned but didn't quote, and I want to quote it correctly. You know, I quoted the line from Valaquenta about the secret fire being put at the heart of the world. And then I said that there was a phrase just like it in Einalindale. And there, Iluvatar says, I will send forth into the void the flame imperishable, and it shall be at the heart of the world, and the world shall be, with a capital B.
Mm.
And that's what we're talking about, that independent existence, that it doesn't exist in the musical score that Iluvatar wrote. It doesn't exist in the playing of the melodies and harmonies that the Ainur did. It exists in reality. It exists outside of the timeless halls, in time.
It's like the music was a blueprint. The vision was a model.
Yes.
The fire gives it reality.
Yeah. At the beginning of time, incomplete.
Yeah.
But that line there about, I'll send forth into the void the flame imperishable, and it shall be at the heart of the world, it really makes that synonymous with the secret fire, because you get that line about it being at the center of the world as well. So, but we still have to answer the other part about Gandalf, don't we?
We've got to come back to the other part about Gandalf. And I think we did talk about this a little bit last season.
Yeah.
When he is confronting the Balrog and he says, I am a servant of the secret fire, wielder of the flame of Anor. And then he says, the dark fire will not avail you, flame of Udun.
We want to deal with those backwards, maybe? Let's start with the easiest one first, Udun.
Yeah, sure. So, Flame of Udun. Udun is simply a Sindarin form of the Quenya word Utumno, which is the name of Melkor's first fortress in Middle-earth. Basically the equivalent of hell.
Yeah.
He's basically calling the Balrog Flame of Hell. And so he's talking about the Balrog being sort of being a servant of the destructive fire of Melkor.
Right.
The corrupting fire that burns and consumes and destroys.
As opposed to the one that gives life.
As opposed to the one that gives life, which is the secret fire, and that's the one that Gandalf serves. Mm-hmm. Obviously, as we see, he is obviously one of the Maiar. We see that he is brought back by the Authority after he falls. So he is very much a servant of that secret fire. But yeah, that's exactly it. He's contrasting the destructive flame with the life-giving flame that he serves. Now, it is strange that he says wielder of the flame of Anor, because Anor means the sun.
But that's what he wields. He's not a servant of the sun. He's a servant of the secret fire, but he wields the fire of the sun. So he's got some destructive power as well, I think is what he's talking about.
And I think we see that the sun is a next best thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
We know that the sun, Anor, is maybe a second best representation of the secret fire in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a fire. It is a life-giving fire, but it is not the life-giving fire, the secret fire.
Right. And one last thing, I think it would probably be ignoring the obvious if I weren't to say that for Tolkien, you know, in his particular worldview, his view in terms of Catholicism, I think it's fair to say that there's a pretty strong analogy with Iluvatar being very much God the Father and the secret fire being very analogous to the Holy Spirit.
To the Holy Spirit, yeah.
And I think we see that as a reminder if we look back at Mythopoeia. There's that wonderful line at the end when Tolkien's talking about, you know, what it'll be like in paradise, right, at the end of time. And he says that in paradise, they look no more awry, and though they make anew, they make no lie. Be sure they still will make, not being dead, and poets shall have flames upon their head. I think he's referencing there something that we see in Acts chapter 2, verse 4, all of them talking about these people that were in a room waiting, apparently, at this point. I should actually go back to verse 3. They saw what seemed to be tongues of fire that separated and came to rest on each of them. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit enabled them. So the idea there that Tolkien's calling on in Mythopoeia is this notion that that same spirit rests on these people who will still create in paradise. And I think that reference to fire really does tie back into the flame imperishable, the secret fire.
Yeah, that makes sense. So. Especially when you look at it as a source of subcreation, right? Which is basically what it is.
And why it's so very closely tied with the Iluvatar, because it's part and parcel of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. You can't have one apart from the other, and yet they're separate. That's
interesting that in Mythopoeia, he talks about poets having flames on their heads after they die, right? In the afterlife. But I mean, really, if you think about it, we all have the secret fire already.
Yeah.
We already have that flame, don't we?
We have the flame. We have that independence, that sentience, that gift of life, you know, in theory. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Fascinating question, though, Joe. Really fun stuff.
Great question, Joe. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Sean, I know we've got some more questions. What's the next one? Or I shouldn't say what's the next one. Who's the next one who's asking it? We'll ask them what the question is.
All right. Well, the next one is from Marilyn.
Marilyn, welcome.
Good evening, gentlemen. Hello, everybody. Recently, I saw a social media post that assumed that Éomer was illiterate. I'm guessing the idea came from Aragorn's words. They are wise but unlearned, writing no books but singing many songs. I never took this to mean that the nobility, at least, of Rohan were illiterate, particularly given all their marriage ties with Gondor over the centuries, not to mention all the treaties and such. But it did start me thinking about reading and writing in Middle-earth. It seems to be linked to class in the Shire and in Bree, given the words of the gaffer to his son Sam, and Butterbur's pride in being a lettered man. Do the Sindarin have wandering tutors? Were all Numenoreans and Dunedain and dwarves able to read and write, or carve? Did the elves of Osirian have slender pens as well as slender bows? Did Olorin come forth from Eru's thought knowing how to read all those ancient texts in the Minas Tirith archives? Trust a teaching librarian to ask, what say you about literacy in Middle-earth?
That is a great question, Marilyn.
I love this question, Marilyn. You know, I'm with you, Marilyn. I never took that comment from Aragorn as meaning that the nobility of Rohan are illiterate. I think they're a society that still values their oral tradition.
Yeah.
I think that's what Aragorn's saying there. They don't write books, but they sing many songs. I don't assume that means they can't read, just that that's the people they are. They don't spend a lot of time reading. They don't spend probably any time writing. Mm-hmm. They record history through songs. I don't think it's a statement about what they can or can't do, just what they value.
What they choose to do, right.
They value that oral tradition, that sort of epic poetry mm-hmm. to record their great stories. And I think that's exactly what we should expect from them.
I agree. So I think she's right to say, yeah, that doesn't mean that Éomer is illiterate.
Yeah.
Just that as a general culture, they don't focus on literacy.
Now, going beyond that to the actual question about sort of literacy in Middle-earth in general, I think it's as hard to pin down as literacy in the Middle Ages is hard to pin down, honestly. Mm. But I think that we can probably assume that not everybody in Middle-earth knows how to read and write. I mean, we know that Barlaam and Butterbur, as Marilyn said, was proud of the fact that he could read and write. Mm-hmm. We know that Sam being taught to read and write by Bilbo was kind of viewed as a weird thing by the hobbits of the Shire, especially like his dad.
Right.
And so I think we can assume that it wasn't as common to be literate as it is in our society by a long shot. Mm-hmm. But does that mean that there were very few people who could do it? I don't get the sense that it was as restricted to the nobility and to like a particular learned class as we might see in the Middle Ages. You know, I don't think that it was restricted to just like monks and learned people. I think that in what we see, generally speaking, in Middle Earth is that there are more people than that who can read and write, mm-hmm. but it's not everybody.
Yeah. We know that certain cultures really did a lot of writing, right? I mean, we talked about the hobbits writing all these books on genealogies that, you know, for them, they might not write books about history. They might not write books with stories and things like that, but they have these genealogies. So they at least have to write down the names and who's related to who and, you know, keep track of all these records. That takes literacy. And of course, they were able to send letters back and forth to each other. I mean, the government only did a couple of things, right? They rounded up stray animals.
Right.
They kind of kept the quote unquote borders. And then there was the post office. That's all they had.
So. Right, exactly. Just deliver the mail, guys.
Right, you know.
Just give me the mail.
And Bilbo, of course, talking about how, you know, I send you all these letters and you never even send me one back.
Right.
Here's a pen.
That in and of itself, and given how much we see the hobbits writing letters, that tells us that, yeah, there must have been lots of hobbits who were literate.
Yeah.
And maybe the only reason Sam and the gaffer weren't literate, or at least Sam wasn't literate until later,
right,
was just because they were working class.
That's the thing. So it would be class-based there.
Probably very class-based, yeah. Beyond that, I mean, what do you think about a place like Minas Tirith? I tend to think that Minas Tirith probably, Gondor in general, probably has a higher literacy rate than some place like Rohan.
Yeah, that makes sense. High, you know, we've talked before about high, middle, and low in terms of the men.
Yeah.
And it would make sense to me to see a place like Gondor have a higher rate of literacy than Rohan, which in turn would have a higher rate of literacy than, say, Dale.
Yeah, yeah.
Though Dale, the businessman, would have to have some sort of, being sort of a cultural hub.
Yeah. And being sort of an economic boomtown in a way, maybe
there's
a higher degree of literacy there.
Good catch. And I would say even within Gondor that a place like Minas Tirith would probably have more literacy than, let's say, the fields of Lebanon. The closer you get to an urban center, the closer you're going to get to, you know, people who are studying things and reading things. Jim, you've got something to say real quick on this. What's up?
Just at the talk of the Rohirrim, writing a few books, but singing many songs reminded me of the ancient Norse and especially the Icelandic people whose oral history was extremely detailed. And that was the way they kept their records for a long time. And in fact, the journeys to Greenland were handed down over 200 years as oral traditions before they're actually written down several hundred years later. And they were so accurate that they were used to discover the landing of Leif Erikson in Newfoundland.
That's true. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I think that's exactly why we should expect to see the Rohirrim be more of a non-literate culture. I don't want to say illiterate because that implies something different. They're just a more of a non-literate culture. They just value the oral tradition more.
I think so. And that makes sense given who they're modeled after, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we know that they are very Anglo-Saxon.
Right.
And the Anglo-Saxon history is an oral history.
Right.
So it's not surprising that the Rohirrim are a people who value their oral history very much. Yeah.
I wonder if the Shire has a higher rate of literacy than Rohan. I bet it probably does.
I wouldn't be surprised.
And I think that makes sense given that the Hobbits are modeled on 19th century England. So from an out-of-universe inspirational perspective, yeah, it makes sense that the Shire would have a higher degree of literacy. Not everybody, not every farmer and gardener, of course, but probably a lot of people in the Shire were literate. If you had to look for an in-universe answer as to why that would be the case, maybe you could say that the Hobbits settled in Eriador. They had been a fief of the Northern Kingdoms for some time, and so maybe you could argue that they might have learned something from them as opposed to the Rohirrim, who are more, like you said, middlemen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the men that aren't high men and they aren't
right. The
low men, right? They're men like the Rohirrim. They're not the Dunlendings, but they're not
right. The
descendants of Numenor. Right.
Now you look at the Dunlendings, I think we can probably assume that the Dunlendings probably had a lower rate of literacy.
Oh, certainly. They might have had almost none at all. They don't have a culture that seems to value that.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't stand the Gondorians, right? They couldn't stand the Numenorians that came there to visit. So
right, that's true.
To visit, to conquer, I guess.
To visit. I figured you put air quotes around that. Yeah.
We're just coming for a visit. No, we're going to conquer and deforest your land.
I have an interesting little tidbit to add to this discussion. One of our listeners and one of our favorite bloggers is Joe H., and he has a blog called Idiosophy that we've referenced a few times.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
As I was kind of just Googling around and trying to find some stuff on oral versus written culture in Middle Earth, he put something down that I actually wanted to go ahead and put it down here. So hat tip, Joe, you're on the show, even if you don't want to be. He's talking about this idea of controlling who hears what, and that oral cultures strictly control who gets to know what. And I'm reading from his blog now. There are initiation rituals, rites of passage that one must pass through before one is permitted to hear. Speakers can usually arrange to see everybody in earshot, but when authors write something down, they have no control over where the paper will end up. Tolkien uses the two media this way. Isildur didn't tell people about the inscription on the ring. He wrote it down lest it fade beyond recall. He did not trust oral history, Joe points out. And he says he had no idea who would need to know it, so he couldn't have guessed whom to tell. And in typical Joe fashion, he says the obvious answer to the latter is Elrond, but that would have been an awkward conversation.
Yeah.
But then he points out that in the immediate context of the Shadow of the Past, Sam eavesdropped on the oral communications between Gandalf and Frodo, but was immediately busted. while Mary got to read a page or two of Bilbo's book with nobody being the wiser. So writing things down is better for disseminating than telling people. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting thing. I think cultures that are more interested in disseminating that information are going to be more focused on writing and literacy.
Yeah.
And that's why the hobbits, who are so fascinated with genealogies, of course they're going to try to figure out, you know, they've got to write this stuff down. The Rohirrim, on the other hand, they only want the people to hear that hear it. So.
Yeah. And I think we have to just understand that Tolkien, as a lettered man himself, and a man who's very... Mm-hmm.
Very lettered.
Very lettered, and his livelihood was letters.
Kind of defines lettered, really.
Pretty much. He's going to value that in his society, and so the more enlightened cultures are going to be the ones that are the more literate, and so you would expect to see the Numenoreans, whether it's Gondor or Arnor, be more literate than the Rohirrim.
Yeah.
Than the Dunlendings. Although I should point out that Marilyn has posted in the chat here, she did clarify for us, some Dunlendings actually could read. There was a spy that was sent maps and notes. Yeah.
That's right. That's a good catch. Well, my goodness, that was an interesting question. I'd love to dive deeper into that. That could be a really interesting sidebar at some point, wouldn't it? Do some deep research on that.
Yeah, I think that would be a lot of fun.
All right. Well, before we continue with more questions, we want to take a moment to remind you about a couple things on our website. First up, so excited, our inaugural PPP Moot is coming. It will run from May 14th to 16th. And you're going to want to visit our website, theprancingponypodcast.com, for more information and to register.
Man, we are so excited about this, and we just cannot wait for all of you to join us.
Yeah.
One of our keynote speakers is going to be Dr. Amy Sturgis. And she's taught courses on everything from Tolkien and Harry Potter to Star Wars and Star Trek.
Yeah.
And she's just a fantastic speaker. Alan and I saw her at last year's MythMoot, and we were just blown away, and we're really looking forward to having her join us.
We really are. And our other keynote speaker is Dr. Michael Drought, who joined us here on the Prancing Pony podcast all the way back on episode 66. He edited the J.R.R. Tolkien Encyclopedia. He's a co-editor for Tolkien Studies. He's been involved with Lord of the Rings Online and so much more. And we are thrilled to have him join us as well.
Now, the theme for our first PPP Moot is going to be digital recovery. It's the many ways we find fairy online and regain a clear view from virtual communities and online fandom. We have got a full slate of presentations, mm-hmm. some other special guests lined up, and a lot of fun social events as well, including... not limited to, but including a pub quiz and a live AMA-style episode recording. So, folks, please plan on joining us.
That is going to be so much fun. Folks, our event page has been up and running for a little bit now, so you can take a look at the schedule, check out our keynote speakers, and most importantly, register to attend this three-day event. Now, we have worked hard to make our Moot as accessible to as many people as possible, both in terms of time zones and cost. It's only $25 for the whole thing, but only if you sign up by March 31st. Now, this episode release is awfully close to that. It means you've just got a few days left to register at that early bird price before it goes up to $35 on April 1st. So don't delay. Go to theprancingponypodcast.com and sign up right now.
That's right. And while you're there, don't forget, our website still has all the rest of the good stuff there too.
Mm-hmm.
Show notes, outtakes, Prancing Pony Ponderings, and our online storefront where you can get Prancing Pony Podcast shirts, mugs, stickers, and more.
Now, one of the best resources we have there is our all-new library. Our web guru, Phil Dean, has worked hard on redesigning the library, and it shows. As you know, we love the books here at the Prancing Pony Podcast, and we want to make sure you can get your hands on any of the books we mention here.
Yeah, we may talk about a lot of Tolkien-related stuff on the podcast, but at heart, Alan and I are fans of Tolkien's books and books about Tolkien. That's why we have the library page, with links to every book we've mentioned on the show.
Now, we do make a few pennies from the purchases you make from those links, so thank you for your support. Well, now it's time to head back to the common room for some more questions from our beloved listeners and the rest of them. Sean, who's up next?
All right. Well, next up, since you put it like that, next up is Arthur.
I swear I didn't know. I didn't know.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, sir. How are you?
Good evening, doctor. How are you?
Very good. I was listening to some modern music recently, mm-hmm. and it occurred to me that the whole fall of Melkor was a misunderstanding when he was listening to Ilúvatar give instructions to the chorus of the Ainur, and he was saying, no, no, less punk, more goth.
Oh.
But I'm not going to ask you about that.
Oh. Oh, man.
I, however, have been engaged in an interesting project over the last several months, reading The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings to somebody who has never read them or seen the movies.
Oh.
Although this person has rolled their eyes numerous times when I talk about it in depth. And it has caused me to be reading things a little bit more detailed and noticing things. And one of the things I noticed that I wanted to toss out for discussion, and then I at the end I may have an answer. In Chapter 6, Book 6, Many Partings, when Aragorn is saying goodbye to Celeborn and Galadriel, and she says, you got good times in front of you, but Celeborn said, kinsman, farewell. May your doom be other than mine, and your treasure remain with you to the end. Which sounds kind of like there's some domestic trouble there. And we know that Galadriel, spoilers for anyone out there, Galadriel sails off at the end of the book across the sea, and Celeborn does not leave until a few hundred years later, according to the prologue. But in elf time, that's like saying, I'll meet you in 5 minutes. So what in the world, does he have some feeling that there's trouble, and when he gets there, they're not going to be married anymore or something? I mean, if we didn't know from the prologue that he went, that he did sail across the sea and took the last living memory of the Elder Deus with him because he made the ship out of Treebeard, you would, you know, what does this mean? What is he referring to that he's losing his treasure?
So I'm going to answer this in a way that I think may not be the obvious answer, but I actually don't think he's referring to Galadriel here. I think he's referring to his daughter, Celebrian. You know, she was captured by the orcs and tortured. There are times where I thought she was killed by the orcs, but she wasn't killed. She just left. After she was tortured, she went to Valinor. So he's been parted from his daughter ever since. And I think that may be what he's talking about. I could be wrong.
I think that's a reasonable interpretation, certainly referring to your treasure. I don't know. Is it something you'd say about your child more than your wife? I guess not necessarily. I mean, but
it depends.
I mean, I'm not saying that he doesn't absolutely love his wife, but
he's standing right next to her. I mean, I could see her going, I'm right here.
Yeah.
I'm right here, Celeborn.
Yeah.
You don't listen to me. It was just like Thingol didn't listen to Melian.
Well, you were my treasure, honey, but come on, you had to bring that up again. I can see that. That seems like a reasonable interpretation. My treasure does kind of sound like something you say of your child.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know that I'm disagreeing, but the only thing about that is that there's no indication of Aragorn having a child at this point, is there? There's no suggestion that he and Arwen are going to have a child. I mean,
no.
I mean, obviously that's the hope when they're getting married and, you know, that's the hope for the future and everything. And right. We know that that does happen, but.
It's a good point.
I don't know. You'd think Aragorn's response would be like, whoa, whoa, kids. I'm so not ready for kids. I'm only 88.
We just got married, yeah. Man. I'm only 88. I still got fun to have. Go to the pub with the guys.
And if it is a reference to Celebrian and he's referencing this future child that Aragorn and Arwen might have, then, oh my gosh. Yeah. Of course you hope your child is not going to suffer the same fate. Right. So that seems like a fairly morbid thing to say, if that's what he's talking about.
Fair.
I'm not saying he's not, but I don't know.
I don't know. I may be reaching, I confess, but it does seem like a really odd thing to say about your wife when she's standing right there.
It does. You're right.
So, I mean, it's a good question, Art. I don't know what the answer is, but boy, I mean, right there, she's got this nice thing, you know, through darkness, you've come to your hope. You now have all your desire. You have now all your desire. Use well the days. And then Celeborn, hope your fate's different than mine.
I mean, wow. Get out while you can, bro.
Yeah, get out.
I mean,
oh, it's
may
terrible.
Your doom be other than mine. Well, of course his doom is going to be other than Celeborn's because Celeborn is an elf and Aragorn is a man.
Well, that's, yeah, there's an obvious thing.
I don't know. He might be talking about Galadriel here and he might be talking about hoping for Aragorn's sake that Arwen stays with him. But then why does he think that Galadriel is going to leave?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, does he know that she's planning to leave sooner than he is?
Well, maybe. That could have been discussed between them. You know, Marilyn actually makes an interesting point. She suggests that possibly his treasure is his granddaughter, referring to Arwen, of course. and that Arwen, who isn't going to stay with Celeborn because she's gone with Aragorn, well, she won't stay with us. Maybe she'll stay with you. And may your treasure, may Arwen remain with you to the end. That may be.
Maybe, but that's not really a very, you know, like-to-like comparison, is it? I mean,
no.
You wouldn't expect your granddaughter to stay with you the way someone would expect their wife to stay with them.
Or even their child, I suppose.
Or even their child. Yeah. And also, that's also kind of awkward.
It's very awkward.
Grandpa, come on. I'm right here.
Yeah. Now Arwen's the one saying I'm right here.
I'm several thousand years old. It's time for me to get married.
Seriously.
I can leave the house now. This is a tough one. I don't know what this is. I don't know what this is about.
I think we're going to get a lot of interesting suggestions from people.
Marilyn also suggested in the chat, may you, Aragorn, die before Arwen does.
Which, oh, man.
That's interesting.
Zing.
May she be with you until the end. May you not have to say goodbye to her, but right. She has to say goodbye to you.
Wow.
Which, again, Grandpa, come on.
Come on, man. That's terrible. Maybe he's just so wise we can't figure out what he means. He is supposed to be wisdom.
I don't know. This is really interesting. I need to think about this one for the next 3 years.
Luckily, we don't get to that point in the show for a very long time. So, yeah, that's what I was thinking. Jim, you've got something to say on this, and I think Art does as well. Go ahead, Jim.
Just that Celeborn did not come from the Blessed Realm, so maybe he didn't expect to ever go there. So he saw the party with Galadriel as perhaps being final, but at last, centuries later, he finally said, yeah, this place sucks without Galadriel. I'm going to head back to the Blessed Realm.
Oh, that could be.
That's an interesting notion. Yeah, that he wouldn't expect to return.
Maybe that's why he assumes that Galadriel is going to leave him. That very well could be.
That's possible. And Arthur?
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, my reading of it, Galadriel is saying to Aragorn about you've got your hope, you've come to your hope, you got your desires have been granted, talking about his spouse. And then Celeborn jumps in, and the parallelism makes me think he must be talking about Galadriel. Now, we know that he's usually smarter than this because back in Lorien, when Boromir made that crack about old wives' tales, Celeborn glanced to his right to the oldest wife in Middle-earth and says, in old wives' tales, there is wisdom. The only thing I could think of here is that Celeborn may have been noticing all the looks going back and forth between Galadriel and Gimli, and seeing all those text messages in her Palantir from Toriel. She was asking for advice, and maybe he figures when he gets to Valinor, and some of the older writings had Celeborn coming from Valinor and not being strictly Middle-earth. Either way, that she's going to be taken by the time he gets there. That's just my headcanon.
That's your headcanon.
I love the idea of Celeborn's secret message here being, man, I hope she doesn't leave you for some dwarf.
Yeah.
Like my wife is going to.
Like I suspect Galadriel's going to do. All right. Well, that was a good question, and it really stumped us because we still don't know. But Sean, we're going to go ahead and move on because we can't answer that one tonight. Who's
no,
up next?
But it's a great question, and I want to think about it some more.
I do too.
All right. Well, next up, we have got Katie.
Ah, Katie, welcome.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
So you've talked before about the various redemption opportunities or offered redemption opportunities to characters in the Legendarium. Maedhros and Maglor were given the opportunity in the end, but seemingly didn't take it. Would you consider Elrond and Elros to be their redemption opportunity, depending on which version of the tale you go with?
Oh, goodness.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, we've definitely talked about redemption before. We've talked about characters that do wrong things, often, if not always, get an opportunity to right those wrongs.
Yeah. And we do know that Elros and Elrond, at least in the version published in the Silmarillion, they were taken in by Maglor, right? Maglor took pity on them.
Yep. Essentially became their foster father, raised them, yeah.
Yeah, love grew after between them, as little might be thought.
I love that line.
So, wow, interesting. Was that an opportunity for Maglor and possibly also Maedhros to redeem themselves? And they still didn't after that.
That's the thing. I think it was an opportunity to begin a redemption arc, I think.
It was an opportunity to turn around and to get off the road they were on.
Right. And I think it started that way. But if they had redeemed themselves in that opportunity, then when the time came, they would have forfeited the
Silmarils,
the last Silmarils.
Yeah,
you know,
that's interesting.
Does a tale that ends with somebody casting themselves into a fissure of the earth, holding a Silmaril instead of turning it over to its rightful owners, is that a story of redemption?
Well, no, certainly they certainly didn't ultimately take the redemption chance that was.
But offered. Was it a redemption opportunity? I think so.
Was it an opportunity for them to set themselves on a road towards redemption?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it potentially was. Yeah.
I do too. Yeah. I think this is a way for somebody who's committed wrong to start committing right.
Mm-hmm. To love something else other than the Silmarils and this oath.
Oh, right. Terrible, terrible oath. Yeah, you're right.
And they did. They did love the boys.
Yeah. Love grew between them as, you know, despite what one would expect. Yeah. I like the idea of a redemption arc for them.
Yeah. But in the end, the curse was just too strong. I mean, the pull of the Silmarils and the oath that they had sworn was just way too strong.
The oath, you know, Maglor and Mythras have that discussion amongst themselves. I can't remember which one. I think it was Maglor wanted to give them back. Maybe not. Maybe it was Mythras. I literally don't remember at the moment, but one of them wanted to give them back. And the other was like, dude, if we give them back, then we're the everlasting darkness. Do you remember?
Right.
We called the everlasting darkness.
It was Maglor who wanted to give them
That's
back.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, Maglor's the one. Maglor always seems, well, I don't know about always, but certainly at this point in the story, Maglor seems to be closer to walking away from the oath than his brother.
Yeah, and he's not the one who ends up casting himself into the fire. He's the one who walks around and becomes...
Brian Wilson.
Brian, or Elvis Presley.
Right.
Or
I still think Brian Wilson, but Elvish Presley is another
Elvis Presley is a great option, yes. No doubt about it. That's an interesting question, though, Katie. I like that.
Well, I do think that Elrond and Elros give them a chance. They set them on the road. I think I said that a moment ago. They set them on this path towards redemption. But it's a path that you have to stay on.
Right.
It's a road. It's a journey. And if you turn away at any point, you're not going to get to your redemption.
No.
And I think that's what ultimately happens, is that they get set on the right road. But in the end, unfortunately, they're drawn away at the last minute. And and we see that, I think tragically, that Maglor really wants to do what's right.
He really does.
And Mythras a bit less so. And Maglor allows himself to be convinced by his brother. So yeah, I think it sets them on a path to redemption, but it is only a path. And it's a path that they have the ability to step off of. It's not like the path to the dark side, where forever will it dominate your destiny.
Oh, come on. You can't just say that without Yoda's voice.
Forever will it dominate your destiny.
Well done, sir.
Thank you. It's not like that. They can walk off the path, and they do. And I think that's what happens.
That is tragic. And I think what we see is the truth that the longer you have in time between the point where you start to redeem yourself and the end of your life, the harder it's going to be to stay on that path.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't help but think about Boromir, right? Boromir, of course, the ultimate redemption story, dies within an hour of his redemption.
Yeah, he doesn't have a chance to get off the path,
right?
Does he? Yeah, that's a really good point.
He does not have a chance.
Yeah.
Would he, had he survived that battle, would he have remained that way? I'd like to think so. I'd like to think that his willingness to die was sufficient to, you know, to carry him along that path, but we don't know. In this case, there was, you know, dozens of years. I don't know the timeline off the top of my head, but there was a very long time before really that final point that Maglor and Mythos were faced with.
Yeah, before the actual War of Wrath and the recovery of the Silmarils and everything. Yeah.
And Marilyn pointed this out in chat, and she's absolutely right. Doing the right thing, even knowing it's going to kill you, is redemption. And that's, again, that's the Boromir thing all over the place.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And that's what makes me see just how close Maglor got. He was willing, almost, to face the everlasting darkness, to face the consequences of his oath were he to break it. And had he done so, I think that would have been redemption, and ironically, he then would not have faced everlasting dark.
Yeah. I like something that Joe's pointed out in the chat here, which is the idea that though they may not actually be redeemed, their names, like sort of their good names, are restored on some level because of what comes out of that. So because of Elrond and Arwen and the final ennobling of man.
And Elros and Numenor.
And Elros and Numenor. And so, yeah, this Joe's just said in the chat that this whole idea of ennoblement kind of hangs on whether Maglor and Mythras take care of Elrond and Elrost.
Right. Or whether they die in a cave of starvation and exposure. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And so in the end, their good deed does bear fruit for Middle-earth. So while they aren't necessarily redeemed for themselves, this idea that their names are restored. I like that idea.
That is a good one.
In some sense, they have tilted the balance sheet a bit more towards the good side.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. Mm-hmm. That is a hard question, but it's a good question, and I appreciate it. Yeah. All right, Sean, I think we've only got one more before we get to a round two, if we even have time for a round two, and that's going to be Keith.
In one of the most recent episodes for the chapter Treebeard, you rightly showed some reticence to discuss Ent reproductive biology. My question is somewhat related to that and concerns Entings, but from a sociological perspective. The book The Hidden Life of Trees by Peter Vorleben provides an incredible glimpse into the social lives of trees, not just how they procreate, but also how they communicate and even recognize kin. Naturally, I was thinking about Ents the entire time I was reading it, and one social construct is the family. My question is, how do you think Ents raise their young, given the differences between Ents and Entwives? And as a corollary, did Treebeard and Fimbrethil have Entings? There is, I don't think, any textual evidence. The easy answer is no, he never mentions them, but perhaps that's because the situation never required it, and the absence of evidence doesn't disprove. What are your thoughts? Was he like Durin alone, though he was in love in his youth?
Oh boy.
Man.
Oh.
Good question. The first thing I think of is that Ents are shepherds,
mm-hmm.
and Entwives are gardeners, right?
Right.
They're horticulturalists.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think that that probably aligns with sort of a traditional 19th, early 20th century perspective on the idea of women being the primary child rearers.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Which we can probably expect Tolkien to have had, not only because of the time he lived in, but just his own life. And the fact that his wife was the one to raise the kids.
Exactly. And then, of course, the fact that his mother was the one who raised them until she died. Yeah.
Yeah. So I suspect that he's probably going with that kind of idea, with the Entings being raised by the Entwives. I don't know that for sure.
I wonder if there was more of a gender split. Like, you know, the Ents, as they would grow, these Entings, if they were Entwives, would fall naturally into the camp of the Entwives and be horticulturists and gardeners, and the male Ents, the male Entings, I should say, would be more like the Ents.
That's an interesting thought.
You know, so that the men raise the men and the women raise the girls.
Yeah, boy Entings learn from Ents and female Entings learn from Entwives. That probably makes even more sense than what I said.
As they reach maturity. I mean, in other words, I don't know how long that would be.
But you're right. They're so different that it probably makes more sense for the boys to be raised by the Ents and the girls to be raised by the Entwives. It probably makes a lot more sense because they're so dissimilar.
They're not just different in their roles or their jobs. They're different in their very nature.
Yeah. However, I think that it could be that the Entwives might be, because they are more caretakers of plants as opposed to the Ents. Well, the Ents are caretakers too, aren't they? They're shepherds. They're just a different kind of caretaker. So, yeah.
They care for the trees rather than the shrubberies and the...
The shrubberies!
I still imagine the Entwives ordering a shrubbery.
That's very interesting. You might be onto something there, and I kind of like that idea that they would be raised by the ones of their own gender.
You can almost imagine the Entwives, you know, congratulations, Mrs. Treebeard, it's a boy! Oh, darn it. You know, you get this one, you know?
Yeah, this one's yours.
I don't know. I mean, I get that feeling only because Treebeard's talking about how there haven't been any Entings in a long time, and he's saying that with regret, right?
Yeah.
They never talk about female Entings. They don't really talk about gender with the Entings at all.
Right.
But it almost seems like a foregone conclusion that all of the Ents, well, we know all the Ents are male because all the Ent wives are gone. We talked about that it doesn't mean spouses, it means women.
Right. We have nothing to go on, so this is all speculation. There's no right or wrong answer here.
Yeah.
I really like the idea that the men raise the boys and the women raise the girls, though.
I think, yeah.
That's a cool idea.
To me, that makes a little more sense. But that would, you know, the sad thing about that is that would just further that split, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you've got the Entings being raised in a community just of their gender.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine doing that with humans? I mean, I know that there are going to be certain tribes and certain cultures that have done that. But imagining, you know, what would happen if Western civilization, if that's what we did, if when a boy was born, it went into a place where only the men were, you know, for its entire childhood and young adulthood before it was out on its own.
Well, I dare say the world wasn't that different from that in Tolkien's time. I mean, when he was a child, you know, when he was at King Edward's school, he went to a boys' school and, you know.
But I'm thinking from birth.
This is very interesting. I think that there could be something to that.
Yeah.
We simply don't know.
No, and I was being a little tongue-in-cheek because I know that we had boarding schools. It was very much like that for, you know, a very long time.
I was being tongue-in-cheek when I made the comparison because I think it was a bit like that, but you're right. I mean, you're talking about something that's really completely split down the middle.
From the nursery, you know, from the get-go.
Yeah.
And it just furthers that separation between the two. An Enting would not grow up sharing any of the values of an Entwife, and an Entwife wouldn't grow up with sharing any of the values of the Ents. It just would exacerbate that problem.
Right.
Over and over and over, generationally.
Yeah. It would definitely make that split much worse as time goes on.
Yeah.
And that alone could be a point in favor of the idea that this is what happened.
That's a very good point. You're right. I mean, almost the results almost tell us what happened.
Almost, yeah. Now, what about the other part of the question? Do you think Treebeard and Fimbrethel had any Entings?
I don't know about kids. Let's take a look real quick at some of the text, though, that's relevant, right? Because they were together for a very long time. First, when he's talking about the story to the hobbits, he's talking about when the world was young and the woods were wide and wild. He's talking about the Ents and the Entwives, and that's when he actually first mentions Fimbrethel. He says, ah, the loveliness of Fimbrethel, of Wandlim the Lightfooted, in the days of our youth. Okay, so they were together in their youth, very, very long time ago. And then later on, when they go to find them later, very fair she was still in my eyes, talking about Fimbrethel, when I had last seen her, though little like the Ent maiden of old. For the Entwives were bent and browned by their labor, their hair parched by the sun, and so on. So clearly they had been together for a very long time and then were parted for an extraordinarily long time. But did they have any kids? Here's what I'm going to say. If they did, I think they might have all been females, because otherwise Treebeard might have introduced his son or talked about his son dying perhaps, or even growing tree-ish.
I'm going to go out on a limb here.
Oh, no, you did not.
I am going to suggest that perhaps Entings are raised in a community of their own gender, as you were suggesting, Alan. Boys raised by the male Ents, girls raised by the female Entwives. And I'm also going to suggest that when Entings are born, they are not actually raised in a family unit. They're raised by the community. And that there probably is not much of a parental filial bond.
That may be true.
Such as what we're used to as humans. That probably an Enting is born, the Ent becomes part of the community. Maybe they don't have a very strong concept of fatherhood, motherhood.
That could be. You're right.
And that would allow us to believe that Treebeard and Fimbrethel had Entings, but it's not like, well, this is my son, because they don't have a concept of sons and daughters so much. It's just an Enting, and it just becomes part of the community.
That's a very good point. I can see that being the case. Yeah, I mean, certainly if they are raised by a gender, they're not going to be raised by just the one Ent who is related to them. They're going to be raised by the community of men.
Right, exactly. It's going to be kind of a tribal thing where they're raised by the village Entwives, the village Ents. Yeah.
Yeah. I can buy that. I can definitely buy that, that they would have had kids, but it would have been irrelevant. It wouldn't have been like kids like the rest of society sees them. It wouldn't have been like, you know, Aragorn having kids or the hobbits having kids.
Yeah. I think they just wouldn't have a concept of it. Once they're born,
they're communal Entings.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter that they have this person's genetics or this person's genetics, other than the fact that they're going to be like the tree that they're like, you know, one is like the ash and one is like the birch and so on. So you're always going to know who's who.
Right. I mean,
sorry. I'm just picturing Treebeard, you know, asking Fimbrethel why their Enting looks like an ash tree.
No,
instead of a big oak.
No. Oh, that's
goodness,
awful.
That's terrible. That is terrible.
Yeah. But yeah, like we saw, like Bregolad belongs to the people of the Rose, right? There's kind of a tribal concept to that.
Subgroup within the group, right?
Right.
But not a familial group necessarily.
Exactly. Maybe that's what it is. Now, that's pure speculation. I've got nothing to back that up, but...
Oh, of course. Just about anything with the Ents and the Entings and all of that is all going to be speculative, but I like that. I like where you're going with that. I could buy it.
I like it.
Well, everybody, seriously, thank you for a set of spectacular questions that I think is going to make for one of our best Questions After Nightfall episodes. We
agreed.
Really appreciate you joining us tonight. And we hope that you can join us again for the next one. That won't be too far away. And to everybody listening, we hope you can join us next week when we ride on through sunset and slow dusk and gathering night to Edoras.
Oh, that's going to be so much fun.
Oh, I can't wait.
People may not know this, but I'm kind of a fan of the Rohirrim. I don't know if anybody's picked up on that.
They might not, Lord of the Mark. They might not know that.
I don't know if I've given that away at some point in the past few years.
I think they all figure that you're, you know, descended from Eärendil instead.
Yeah, well, I wish. Yeah. I'd love a little bit of that elven blood in me.
Would be nice.
But hey, in the meantime, while you're waiting for that, don't forget that the conversation continues all night long at the Prancing Pony. Our amazing listener community keeps the discussion going in all of our social media spaces. At our Common Room on Facebook, you'll find comments, questions, corrections, and more on every episode, as well as updates from us throughout the week. Just look for the Prancing Pony Podcast on Facebook.
And be sure to follow the page and join the group that we've recently created. The page lets us keep you up to date on the latest PPP happenings, like our digital moot, while the group gives you a great chance to discuss Tolkien with your fellow listeners.
And of course, we also have some really good discussions going on over on Reddit. You can find us there at r/PrancingPonyPod. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, both with the handle at PrancingPonyPod. And if you're enjoying the show, please share us and consider giving us a review on Apple Podcasts.
And if you want exclusive content, postscripts, full bonus episodes, live Discord events with Sean and me, and episodes without digital ads, then check out patreon.com/PrancingPonyPod, where you can support the show by joining the Fellowship of the Podcast. Well, folks, that wraps it up for another episode of the Prancing Pony Podcast, but be sure to join us again next week when we finally get back to the text and the first of three episodes on The King of the Golden Hall.
Now, as always, we want to take a moment to thank our patrons at the Círdan's Contribution tier, some of whom are with us tonight. They are DeMay in Alaska, James in Virginia, Tamsin in Minnesota, Chad in Texas, Lance in New Jersey, Paul in Colorado, Jerry in Texas, Bruce in California, Mario in Utah, Seth in Texas, Ella in California, Joseph in Texas, Kathy from North Carolina, Lori from Washington, Josh in Oklahoma, Carlos in California, Brian from the UK, Cameron in Nevada, Ned from Connecticut, Thad from Georgia, and Jerry from Washington. Thank you all so much for your support. Alan, we're going to have to split that list soon.
We really are. Yeah, I think one more and we're going to have to just cut that in half and you'll take some, I'll take some. It's amazing and we really are appreciative. We also, of course, want to express our appreciation to the folks that help make this show better. Our research assistants, along with our Barlaman, Becca Davis, producer Jordan Rennells, social media manager Casey Hilsey, event and Patreon community coordinator Katie McKenna, and website guru Phil Dean.
This show absolutely would not be what it is without our supporters and our teammates. So thank you all so much. Now, folks, be sure you don't miss any episodes of the Prancing Pony Podcast. Subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
And one last thing, as always, don't forget to send your thoughts, comments, and most of all, your clarifications of anything we've missed or misstated tonight to Barlaman@theprancingponypodcast.com.
Barlaman is a lot more reliable these days.
Yeah, because it's not us.
That's right, exactly. But we get a lot of mail, and we'll get to you as soon as we can. And who knows, your question or comment may be featured on a future episode.
And as always, this has been far too short a time to spend among such excellent and admirable listeners. But until next time,
farewell, friends.